Welcome to the Scream Team.
Scream Team. Yeah. Woohoo. Pilot episode.
We've been talking about this for a long time.
Yes. Embarrassingly long. I'm sorry. We could have recorded this 2 days earlier, but I got nervous and also forgot mostly that second one. That's my bad. But it's okay because we're recording now.
We are, and it's glorious. It feels very good to be able to finally talk about, well, first of all, to have an inaugural outing for the Scream Team, but also to talk about two movies that are very dear to my heart that just happen to be related to each other. So this week we're talking about Suspiria, the 1977 Dario Argento film, and then the 2018 remake. And so let's go ahead and launch into it. Morgan, you came fresh to, I had a different approach in that I've known of Suspiria for at least 25 years, and I'd seen it many times, and I have the soundtrack, and I used to show clips of it in my film classes, and I, you know, it's one of my favorite films ever. And then so hearing that there was a looming remake coming, I began to dread what that meant. And was very skeptical for a long time, and then finally saw it in the theater, loved it, and now I find it even more fascinating to compare and contrast. But you, when you came into this, had sort of you were a clean slate. I mean, maybe you had heard of Suspiria. I don't know. Tell me about what's your background?
I literally hadn't heard of this movie or Mr. Argento until you were like, hey, let's do this one for the pilot episode. I had to go Google it. I had to figure out what it was. I had to figure out where to watch it. It was streaming on some obscure, I think it's called like Tubi TV, Tubi TV. I don't remember. But the important part was that it was free. And so I streamed it in my bedroom, like super late at night. And I watched it and was like, well, it was really colorful. Like, visually, it was super appealing. I really like that dude's fascination with colors, which, in contrast, the remake, which is not really a remake because the story is different, but it's not really a reboot, is it?
I know the director, Luca Guadagnino, he mentions that he used it kind of as an inspiration. He himself said it's not a remake. He felt like it was an experience he had as a film fan, that it was kind of embedded in his psyche, the original film, and it was something that kind of informed a lot of what he did. But he wanted to try to use that known quantity as sort of a jumping off point for his way of exploring what that meant to him personally. And so, yeah, I mean, it's loosely defined as it being a remake. There are a lot more story elements that relate than I was expecting. But yeah, there's quite a bit different about it too, that it very is much its own thing. And I think if you're going to do a remake, that's kind of the best thing to do. I mean, trying to do a shot-for-shot remake of something seems a little bit pointless. But to take it and use it as inspiration to go a little bit different direction, I think a lot of times that can come out much more interestingly than just doing a rehash just for the sake of it.
Yeah, and this version, very beige. Beige everywhere. You get beige. You get beige. What's that over there? Oh, it's more beige. Not a lot of color as compared to the original, where it was really gorgeous. There's just reds and violets, and this thing over here is blue, and this other thing is orange. I just thought it looked cool. And it was one of the most 70s things I've ever seen, which I also enjoyed.
Yeah, Dario Argento, he made his career on the, I mean, he helped pioneer the giallo subgenre in Italy during the late 60s, early 70s. Argento really came on board in the very early 70s with films like the Cat of Nine Tails, The Bird with Crystal Plumage. Deep Red is a very famous, that's probably one of the most famous horror films from that era. Profondo Rosso is the Italian name, but Deep Red. And all of his films are characterized from, all of his films from that period are characterized with the very saturated color schemes, but, you know, those certainly were not his invention. That really came from Mario Bava and a few of the other very notable Italian directors that preceded him. But they kind of collectively defined what the giallo subgenre is about. Now, traditionally, it never has anything to do with supernatural ties. There can be sort of things that maybe could occasionally point to something supernatural, but never any real, like, acknowledgement. I mean, it's more just kind of masked stalkers who are pursuing these beautiful women in these very gorgeous, kind of like touristy locales, and they've always got the very saturated color schemes and the really swanky lounge music and the crazy like dream sequences. So I mean, they're as close to horror in that they depict some nightmarescapes in the course of the proceedings, and they're generally more kind of thriller and mystery based than anything, but they've always got like a very strong touch of the surreal to them, and they're often very ambiguous. But this was the first time where you get one of those, a film in that style that does overtly have a supernatural underpinning to the whole thing by the end. And even though that's what I loved about it. The first time I saw it, as I was getting into giallos, it blew me away, and I thought that was the high water mark. Well, then I encountered all the online chatter and arguments about, well, Suspiria shouldn't be ranked as being a giallo because it's not true to its roots, because there's a witch, and she actually does supernatural things in the course of it, and I could concede that. I'm like, okay, it's not purely a giallo, but it's kind of taking what he was already, the mode he was already working in with Deep Red and The Bird with Crystal Plumage and Cat of Nine Tails, and then he suddenly, like, just, you know, injected one extra element into it, and it worked like magic.
Pun intended.
And by the way, this is kind of eerie. The script itself for Suspiria, which was largely written by his then partner, Darian Nicolodi, who is Asia Argento's mother. I don't believe Daria and Dario were ever married, but they were partners for a very long time, and they also worked on a lot of professional projects together. But she came up with the idea based on a story that she had heard. I want to say it was about her grandmother who had heard of this happening in East Germany during, I don't remember the exact era, but it was it was sometime in the early 20th century in East Germany. There was supposedly a dance school run by, supposedly it was run by a coven of witches, and there was some sort of news report about some sort of weird goings-on that had occurred around this school. So she kind of took that idea she had heard as a news item and developed it into a story that then he directed. So it's interesting to know that there's real roots to the story.
I feel like I can't contribute to this conversation at all because this is all new information to me.
But I don't think...
on many levels.
I mean, that's just like a trivia item. I don't think that really makes a difference, because the story itself doesn't really matter, at least in you know, maybe it matters a little bit more in Guadagnino's version, but Argento's version, all of his films were much more about, I would say most of his giallo films never were about story structure and characterization and having good dialogue. They were about being kind of like real life fairy tales almost on screen, where it was more about the tone and the mood. And you really get that in the original Suspiria from 77 because of the color saturation, because of the dubbed voices for some of the cast, and the mannered acting. I mean, it's largely caricatured acting style and very mannered dialogue that just comes off as funny, but that makes it even scarier in a way because there's something inherently creepy if you have just the right amount of cheese kind of interlaced into something that's potentially very dangerous. It makes it all off-center that much more. And the music, the score by Goblin, which is, I think, hands down one of the best film scores ever. It's just that music box theme gets just embedded in your head, and the way it is strung throughout the entire movie, and it builds, it crescendos, and then it dies off, and then minutes later you start to hear the percussion picking up again, and it's so wonderfully done in that way. But it makes it more of sort of a moving tone poem. It's really more about the atmosphere and the experience than it is to understanding who this character is and how the witch came into being and all that kind of stuff that most stories would have focused on. Argento was not so interested in all of that.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if maybe that's why I preferred the newer version to the older version. Because there were a little bit more narrative, narrative bones, I guess. Because, like, in this, I don't know, it just felt like in the original, it felt like they never explained why the witches were wanting to kill this specific person or what they were doing. And then in the new version, we get kind of a better idea of what they're trying to accomplish.
So, yeah, that's interesting. And I think, you know, that really has a lot to do with, just, you know, viewer preferences, whether you like more story or less story. I'm generally a fan of less story, but I understand that majority likes more detail. And I don't know. I think I really appreciated the added exposition with the new one. I thought it was refreshing because it was almost like, even though it's not trying to be the same film, the fact that it kind of still inhabits the same space psychologically as the original, to me, getting all these extra details about different characters and about the history of the school and everything, to me, I kind of took that as canonical references. Like, there were like a lot of gaps that kind of got filled in for me anyway, that made me appreciate the original more and made me want to watch the original again. But I also really loved some of the real-world stuff that was being introduced in this new film, particularly like the terrorist footage on the television.
Yeah.
I feel like that, it took me a while to make the connection between what the footage of these hostages were in relation to the story. And then, you know, after it settled for a while and it all came into, you know, it came into place, it made me really appreciate some of those touches. And even like the way that the new one is divided into six acts and an epilogue, like I found that brilliant, having those title cards that so cleanly divides it up. We're warned at the beginning. I don't know that warned is the right verbiage there, but yeah. Six acts and an epilogue in a divided Berlin. The fact that it has to mention in a divided Berlin, we immediately kind of get the sense that there's about to be some sort of history interwoven with the proceedings. And we do get that even all the way up to the very end. And then even after the end credits, there's a little stinger scene that kind of brings things full circle for one of the characters.
Yes, I really, really, really enjoy when movies with, like, supernatural or otherwise kind of, like, really reaching for, could this actually happen in real life, when they tie details to, like, the history, if they're in, like, a known time period, makes it feel a little bit more realistic, which I enjoy when I, you know, watch horror films. I like the idea of, oh, no, this monstrosity could also happen here in this plane of reality.
Yeah.
So...
And I have to say, the filmmaker myself, I'm really struggling with that idea lately, just for some future projects I have. One in particular, where I really, really want to deal with I won't go into detail, but I really want to use without blatantly coming out and saying, this is who these characters are, they are nonetheless based on very well-known characters, but they also have historical precedent, so I know I can absolutely have license to use these characters, but I want to, if I were to present them in the way that people know them visually already, it would be laughable. People would think it, just from the concept itself or seeing a poster, they would think it was cheesy, and most people would not think of it as a horror film. They would not even want to explore it, because many different people I approached with this idea, and they felt like, no, I wouldn't watch that, or no, that would be just a comedy, right? And I'm like, no. And I'm trying to get over this idea of, like, how do you make something that, once it has been saturated enough in the public consciousness over time, like, once a monster has been become a stock character that everyone knows, whether you've seen the films or not, then they kind of cease to hold any power. And how do you make that scary again? And that was the only thing I came to was, well, you embed it into history or into a real life situation that could occur to the extent that people can suspend their belief enough to be moved by what it is. Even though they may not be scared, they could still be entertained by the notion of what's being presented. So I agree with you that the historical fabric is much more, it lends a great deal of power and resonance to the story.
Well, yeah, and remember that people have kind of already been doing that for a second. I'm sure there are several characters that are based off of, like, actual real-life murders. Like, I feel like, is it Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that was inspired by, what was that guy's name?
Partially inspired by Ed Gein, yeah. Or Gein, Ed Gein. But, you know, Ed Gein also inspired Psycho, as well as, what's the other? There were like three major horror icons that all got spawned from his existence and his goings on. But yes, yeah, Leatherface is very commonly attributed with him. But if you want to even, if you want to get even more crazy, I always thought Ed Gein was a better reference, as a better template for Norman Bates in Psycho than he was for Leatherface. But there was because there was a family in Kansas, and I cannot believe this is not better known, and perhaps by us having this mention on the podcast, some filmmaker out there is going to hear this and run with it. But there is a family, I believe it was in the 1930s, during the Depression in Kansas, called the Bender family. And apparently they really were kind of like the family on Texas Chainsaw Massacre and or House of a Thousand Corpses. They were all sociopaths, and they were all related to each other, and they would lure people in to their home. And I want to say that there was a circus connection with them. I believe, like, at least some of the family members, if not the whole family, were circus performers. And so they had ways of luring people to their house, and they would torture them and eat. They were actually cannibals. Like, it was it's this horrifying thing. You're like, how does no one know about this? This is like one of those true life history things that is just out there that hasn't been caught up within the public consciousness yet. So, yeah, they're like, these things can and do happen sometimes, which is a little terrifying.
Man, I would. Does that make me mess up? But I would watch a movie about that. Because I guess there's kind of already movies like that. But if someone just straight up made a movie about the Bender family, I would watch that.
Oh yeah, I'm sure a lot of people would.
It'd be pretty interesting to see. Oh, but speaking of gore and gratuitous violence, I also really liked the second one because it was more violent.
I was going to ask you about that, how you felt, because the scene, and I'm, of course, making the assumption here that anyone listening to this has probably seen the new one. I don't know. How far should we go towards spoiler territory?
Should we put it in the bumper at the beginning?
We can perhaps do that.
Do like a very small disclaimer, like, hey, this podcast is not spoiler free.
I think it's more fun to just be out with it all and be honest about everything. And yeah, if you care enough about Suspiria to perhaps not have seen the remake and you were wanting to, I would say put things on pause now and go watch it and come back. You'll probably be more fueled to listen after having digested that. But yeah, I was going to ask you about the scene with the very gory. Well, there are actually two with the sort of contortionist death by contortion, which were very much nods to some of Argento's kills in the first film, which at the time were very shocking. A woman falling into a room full of barbed wire and struggling to get out and being lacerated to death by her own movements. A couple of things like that, but this really takes it up tremendously.
Yes, and I would like it noted that I did not say that to mean that the first one, like, isn't violent, because it absolutely is, and that was more scary to me because I sat and really thought about, like, what I was seeing. Now, obviously, it was the 70s, and our kind of movie special effects have come a little bit farther since, you know, 40 years ago, or whenever. But I still did like the deaths in the first one. But, like, man, that contortion scene, I think it, like, their sound editing was amazing because I felt nauseous. Like, I went to go see Us with Jordan. There was a death scene in that movie where the sound editing was excellent. And it felt like it went on forever. And I was like, am I about to throw up? I think I might be about to be sick. But it was just the sound and the blood, and just like the bruising and like everything else that would happen if someone died like that, that I think people tend to forget, like, the visuals about.
Yeah. Yeah, and still to this day, you know, I'd been waiting on the film to come out on DVD or, you know, I don't know. Can you even get bonus features on streaming content? I'm still so old school. I'm always looking for the DVD copy of things. I want to listen to Running Audio Commentary. I want to access all the EPK files. I want to see the documentary on how things were done. I'm dying to see how that sequence in particular was handled. I'm assuming, I would hate to say that there was CGI involved, but I know there has to have been, like, it's too convincing and too bizarre. Like, it would have been, I'm not saying it would have been impossible without CGI, but if they did use it, it was very flawlessly handled. And it is a hard, hard scene to sit through. I mean, I've seen way more extreme stuff, of course, particularly stuff that came out of the 70s. But, you know, a lot of that had to do with, like, just stuff that was primarily disturbing at their core that involved children or animals or whatever, stuff that they don't do in film anymore because now it's taboo to go down those roads. But so, I mean, there have been things I've squirmed a lot more during than this scene that we're describing from the new Suspiria, but it's very, very effective. And it's kind of, if you are a horror fan, particularly a fan of the gore side of things, which, you know, I kind of, you know, I'm not extremely in that camp, but, you know, I do like a little bit of that from time to time, particularly when it's new and inventive. Yeah, I thought the movie really, in terms of being, you know, wearing its horror legacy on its badge, you know, on its sleeve, it really it was very successful to that end.
Well, and I think one of the reasons why that violence in the newer Suspiria is so effective is because it doesn't carry the entire narrative. It's kind of like, oh, what was that movie? Crimson Peak, where they're like, it's not a ghost story. It's a story with a ghost in it. This is in that same vein. Like, this isn't, you know, a gore film. It's a film with gore in it. Because, like, I love horror, but I'm, like, also not super into, like, the ultra-gory side of things, like movies like Hostel and Final Destination, where it's really just kind of a pissing contest of what are the most creative, violent
ways. It's not Human Centipede level.
Yeah, brutalize this human body for what's probably, you know, tends to be a weaker narrative because they're completely relying on the shock factor of their visuals to carry it as a story. But Suspiria doesn't do that, and that's why I liked it, and why I'm glad that we didn't start with a movie like Hostel or Final Destination.
Yeah.
Like, even when I had to, like, have a choice between movies like that and, like, slasher films, like, I'd rather watch Friday the 13th or A Nightmare on Elm Street, like, if I had to pick.
Yeah, because they're more like, they're in a way, they're kind of like a cartoon. It's
especially A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh yeah, and it's because they're fun. It's I don't know. There's just something zany about them. It's such an odd. I don't know that there was ever anything in cinema history until those horror franchises of the 80s kicked into gear. But it's just there's that. I don't know. There's something about the level of respectability of where you know that they probably, where they fall, but you just can't acknowledge it because they're so much fun. It's fascinating to take something that could involve so many gruesome deaths. I mean, there are some deaths in the Nightmare on Elm Street series. One in particular I'm remembering from Dream Warriors where, I can't even let my mind flit upon that very much every time I watch that film I cringe a lot because it's just the concept of what's happening is just so extreme to me, but ultimately it doesn't haunt me, and it doesn't make me want to go take a bath afterwards and feel like I've lost a piece of my soul forever, like a lot of other things I've seen. Because I know ultimately it's a cartoon. I know Freddy's the kind of circus showman, and he's, you know, it's all his territory. He's the ringleader, and we're just kind of buying into it because it's fun to watch him be bad.
Going off. Okay, there we go. And I know it's like a weird hipster thing to say, but there are horror movies that kind of know that they're horror movies and they have fun with it.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes them great, is that they've learned to successfully kind of straddle both sides of the...
And I appreciate when you can compare, when you have the ability to compare what they could be one way and what they could be the other way. If you watch Wes Craven's New Nightmare from 1994... That movie, to me, is golden. I believe that film is one of, hands down, the best horror films ever because it is dead serious about the legend of Fred Krueger. There's no jokes. I mean, there are a few kind of stupid one-liners, a few. But Freddy is certainly not cheesy in the film at all. It's like he is a pure dream demon. Like, it was all about trying to return him to his roots. And the way that it's interwoven into reality, and, you know, it's another one of those what-if sort of scenarios. And it pulls upon ancient myth and all this stuff. It's so powerful. And then you can compare that to just a few years later, you had Freddy versus Jason. And then it's like apples and oranges, but I love both of those movies equally. Freddy versus Jason is just flat out a laugh out loud a minute because we all knew the stock conventions of what to expect from either property going head to head with each other, and like it ticked every box I had been waiting on for 20 years to finally see the completion of that film, and I loved it to death, but I love it just as much as the one that's super serious.
Well, that I think also falls into under a like viewer preference, because I personally love dark, gritty remakes of things that weren't necessarily super dark and gritty before. I'm not saying that every single franchise necessarily needs that. I'm just saying that's something that I like. But then you have this other camp of people that are like, not everything needs to be remade to be super serious, which, depending on like the source material, that could be true. I'm trying to picture, I don't know, a super serious remake of like one of the Care Bear movies, and that would be silly. Mm. It's true.
Yeah.
But like other series though, like, I don't know. Oh, the only thing that comes to mind is Power Rangers, which is so dumb, and I didn't even see it. I know there are better ones out there, but that's just the one that I can think of off the top of my head at the moment.
Yeah, well, that's a good example, actually.
Well, and I don't know if I would say that the new Suspiria is a, like, air quote, dark and gritty remake, which, first of all, we've established it's not a remake. Second of all, like, I don't know, I'm having a hard time articulating what I'm trying to say. Is it dark and gritty, like, if the original was also, like, maybe not dark and gritty, but still is equally violent, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Like, you can't really have a dark and gritty remake of something that was already, like, meant right. to not necessarily be super fun.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I almost misspoke and said that the original was kind of more hinged upon those violent deaths. But then I remember, you know, there is a pervasive dread throughout that whole film. All the business of putting up the sheets in the gymnasium and having the girls set up temporary cots and getting undressed, and you see their shadows of them undressing and stuff. There's like a lot of implied titillation there, that then, you know, you also have the act of them undressing, knowing that you don't trust these witches, and it's like they just become so vulnerable. They're all huddled into this one room together, and just the interplay of shadows against the sheets and their their half naked bodies, which, you know, again, I don't believe you actually see. It's just all implied in shadow, but you feel more dread in that moment because they are disrobing and you know that you, at this point in that film, you do not trust the headmaster of the school or any of the other weirdos, like the Romanian woman, the fat Romanian woman with the little boy. And you get those little moments where, like, you know, Susie Banyan, she sees she looks at that, you know, that woman and, who I don't think is her son, he's just like another helper of the school, but like she gets blinded by the light reflecting off the woman's jewelry, or, you know, something like that. I can't quite recall, but yeah, you get those little weird moments, and it's just this mounting dread, and there's a lot of mystery to that. And I think that was very effective in the new film as well. You do get a big sense of that happening. I thought they both did a good job of having that mounting tension and wanting to know more about what's happening behind the scenes, punctuated by these very graphic deaths.
Oh, yeah. And that the climax that was the very strange ending scene in the basement.
Let me tell you, that was a trip to see in a theater, a packed theater. Most of the people there had no idea what they had wandered into. And for me, I thought, this is like a Jodorowsky film, and it's part of a more mainstream sort of film. What is everyone in this room thinking right now? Crazy orgy with demons and... Yeah, what did you think about that whole sequence?
Well, first of all, just tits. Tits everywhere, and that's fine. That's how I watch movies. But it's just like, oh, okay, cool. I guess this is that kind of party. And then the twist where she reveals that, oh yeah, spoiler alert, if you didn't listen to us earlier, we done told you anyway, where she reveals that she is, you know, the High Mother and is here to, like, yeah, y'all fucked up. It's okay, though. I'm going to fix it and also kill everyone. I mean, not everybody. And then poor Tilda Swinton's character, who did a wonderful job in this movie.
Three times over, by the way.
Oh my gosh, she's so talented. I want to be her friend so bad. Anywho, I could gush for literal years about Tilda Swinton. I really, really, really enjoyed her performance as the headmistress teacher lady. I cannot remember anybody's name.
Well, I think I've been a huge Tilda Swinton fan for 30 years now. The first movie I ever saw her in was Orlando from 1989, based on the Virginia Woolf novel. And you know, she's so striking that I couldn't help but be like, who is this? And then all of a sudden, you know, I see her popping up in everything over the ensuing next two decades. But for me, the high water mark for her acting and for her embodying a character was The White Witch in the Narnia films. And I thought she did such a brilliant job with that. And I thought, I don't know that I'll ever see another, a better Tilda Swinton performance. And she knocked it out of the park with this film, especially, as I said, three roles over. I cannot believe how much she gave of herself for this movie. It's amazing.
And it shows big time. Tilda Swinton has mad acting chops. It is great to watch. So the casting in this movie, I think, was really good. And I was really surprised at the performance of, oh my gosh, what is her name? I am 85% sure it's the same person that plays Anastasia in the 50 Shades of Grey movies.
Oh, yeah. I
if think it's not
you're
the
right.
same lady, they look like they could be related. Because if it was the lady from 50 Shades of Grey, which is, I'm still not unconvinced that it's not her, I was really surprised at her performance as Susie as well. And I was like, oh, okay. Because, I mean, the cool kid thing to do is to shit all over those movies, which, to be honest, they're not that great. Neither are the books that they're based on. But, I don't know, it was cool to see her do something outside of that, because I think at this point that's kind of all that she's known for. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, she was, in fact, you know, I do remember, even though I had seen 50 Shades of Grey, I don't, you know, I'm just going to roll this out right now, because I hate not knowing now. Let's see, I'm sure some of our listeners are like, stop, how do you not know this already?
Oh,
yes, hey, you're right, yes, 50 Shades of Grey, so, yeah,
okay.
I mean, you know, I saw that film, thought it was okay, but, you know, but as an actress in that film, she didn't really strike me in any particular way. But, yeah, in this film, I was actively, you know, I always have this idea when I'm watching a film with an actor who is a lead that if I don't recognize him from something else, my assumption has always been that this is their first screen role ever, which, obviously, that's horribly wrong. I mean, I should know better. And most of these people, you know, before you're a lead in a film, you're going to have 50 television roles behind you already, and you've, you know, probably been a lead in a couple of other, you know, lesser films leading up to this point. But I always have this, I don't know, I'm such an optimist about people being, you know, being cast out of left field just because of, you know, the way they look to a casting director as they pass them on the street. And I guess I know Ed Furlong. I've always been touched by his story about, he was plucked out of a pizza parlor in wherever. I don't know if it was in L.A. or not. But, you know, he had this little kid in a pizza parlor with his friends playing arcade games. And, he immediately gets cast in one of the most high-profile sequels of all movie history. But, yeah, I didn't recognize Dakota Johnson from what she had been in that I'd seen her in before, but I was really captivated by her performance. You can tell that there's strength to her character.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what is the name of the actress who played Patricia, because I have seen her in things too. It's Chloe something. Chloe starts with an M.
Oh, Moretz. Is it Chloe Grace Moretz? Is that right? The middle name?
I'm really excited to see her.
Yeah, and she was in, and talk about remake, she was in the remake of Let the Right One In.
Yes, she was. I remember that now.
And in fact, I'm glad that it came back around to mention of that, because that's how I liken this relationship of the original Suspiria and the new one. I felt like the Matt Reeves remake, the American remake of Let the Right One In, it's a little bit, he was a little bit more faithful to trying to strictly copy the original film, which, you know, had only preceded it by a couple of years. But I was blown away by both films. I thought they were both equally powerful for a little bit different reasons, and I consider them equals, just like I consider these two, even though, I mean, it's still comparing apples to oranges, but it's just such a rare occurrence that you do get a remake or a reimagining that can kind of stand next to the influence of an original, but for slightly different terms, and feel like a complete and new artistic vision.
Yeah. Trying to think of any examples off the top of my head that I really enjoy, but I can't think of any at the moment.
What about the music? Like, the Goblin score in the original film, like I said, is one of the most iconic horror film scores ever, and there's a huge, huge fan base that Goblin has. Not just from music, but from specifically from people within the horror community who discovered them because of that film. And it almost seemed a bizarre concept to try to do anything Suspiria related without that sort of music box backing. And it almost went completely against the grain, as much as they went from super saturated colors to very low, neutral-based beiges and grays. They did the same thing with the score, too. You went from this very kind of pounding synth score that was very energetic to something very restrained. Tom York's compositions are very minimalist and just very understated. But yet I felt like it was very, very well done.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they switched up the styles of the score and the music, which, first of all, getting Tom York to do the music on your movie is always a good idea in literally every situation.
Yeah.
Tom York is great at the end, kid thinks bye. Anyway, it would have been a little weird, maybe not weird, but I'm just trying to picture, like, their musical styles and their, like, film aesthetics and, like, swap them, and that just seems really... It would be strange to watch a movie with those kind of vivid colors with a very, like, almost, I don't want to say traditional, I guess classic, more classical-sounding movie score, and then you've got this movie over here that's got a very restrained color palette with just, well, with Goblin. I'm like, these things don't seem to match. So I'm glad that they kind of took that into consideration when selecting who they wanted to do the background music and stuff.
There's a fan edit in there somewhere. I'm sure that at some point we'll get it. I'm sure someone's going to take the new Suspiria and go through and color grade the entire movie to make it have that original color palette and swap out Tom York's score for the Goblin one just as an experiment to see how it reads. And I would love to watch that and get a bead on what difference it makes, but or vice versa. What would that be to take the original and strip its color, you know, desaturate the film and put Tom York's music in it?
That would be hard because the saturation already makes so many shadows, and the idea of shadows kind of influencing how you saw like each shot. I don't know, if you strip the colors away, then you would just have shadows. How would that work? I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it seems like that would be a lot of effort.
Well, believe me, there's a whole community of people, and I'm sure if it's not already in the works, it will be, because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these things out there. This is what my dissertation at the moment that I'm finishing up is about fan edits. Is I find it in this whole nature of, you know, I do, you know, I said I had a knee-jerk reaction about the very idea that someone would remake this sort of hallowed film classic, even though it's not like, you know, people on the street aren't aware of it, but the horror people within the horror community, it's very much a staple. But, you know, look what comes out of it. At least when there is a reimagining or a remake or whatever, it's very cool to compare and contrast and find out what works, what doesn't. It's different for every person. And to that same effect, now that technology is allowing fan editors to really mess around with the original source materials and put out, I mean, there are some stunning fan films out there that just pull off something that would have been unheard of or impossible at any time prior to 5 years ago. But it's, I mean, one example is taking the original print of 2001, A Space Odyssey, and replacing all the music with the original Alex North score, which was famously complete and ready to premiere with the film, and it was just a matter of 2 weeks or so prior, Kubrick changed his mind, said, oh, forget it, scratch it, we're putting all classical compositions in the film. So it's interesting now that it, you know, someone has taken the time and the labor to go in and replace a whole score just so you can get an idea of what the film would have been like otherwise. So it's kind of the same thing with like the nature of remakes and reimaginings to have that sort of ability.
It's like getting glimpses into different timelines.
Exactly.
In some reality, that's what those people got, and we have some super weird fan edit. God, I love the multiverse theory. I don't care if it's not real. let me have it. Anywho.
So I have to ask you, I know you said you prefer the new one, and I would say that I'm, you know, given that the original, given that the new film is really, it really is about double the running length of the original. You know, even with that in mind, I still really, I think I come down like, I don't know that I could pick a favorite between the two. I really like them equally, but I find it very curious on, I know Rotten Tomatoes should not be the end all be all of comparing a film's worth, but I find it very strange in a way. The original Suspiria has a 93% and the remake has a, I forgot what it was. Let me double check so I'm not misquoting it. The original has a 93% and the new one has, I mean, it's something like, where is it? Here it is, 66%. I mean, that's a pretty big drop, but I don't agree with that. I don't understand. And I think the thing about it is that I remember the reviews at the time. I was really kind of hesitant to go see it for a while after it was released. It took, you know, I didn't see it until a couple of weeks in, but I remember all the reviews I was seeing that came out about it. A lot of them said that the movie was too pretentious. Like they attacked it for trying to be something that they felt what they felt like it was trying to make high art out of something that was exclusively like a kind of lower reaching story or you know, something built around the kick of watching really violent deaths on screen. I don't know. But I never got any bit of pretension about it. I mean, yeah, there's all the stuff with like, you know, the East German terrorists, and you've got the big bold lobby cards, or not lobby cards, but the text cards between the intertitles breaking up all the each section of the film. And I mean, there is, it's a very slow, restrained sort of pedestrian style. The whole pacing and the framing and everything, you know, does make it seem like more of an art house film than its progenitor. But to me, I mean, I loved that. And I couldn't understand so many reviews attacking it for saying it was too pretentious.
What does that even mean?
That's like, one of those words where if a critic really wants to not like a film, you can just, that's a buzzword you can throw out and you don't have to explain it.
I mean, like, okay, I can understand when a person is pretentious, but I'm trying to apply the same characteristics to a movie and coming up short. I do not understand, like, movies can't, like, how would it have been talking down to anyone? You know?
I thought it was incredibly restrained and clever. Like, if they wanted to try to, I mean, they could have, in a lot of ways, gone. Well, here's another example. The Exorcist prequels, Warner Brothers commissioned the Exorcist prequel, and Paul Schrader, who's very famous for having scripted Taxi Driver, amongst other things, he directed the film, and everyone was so excited because it was someone of his caliber who came on board to come up with the backstory of Father Marin. This wonderful, like, everyone had this idea of what it would be, and then the studio saw it and said, no, we're just going to dump it, and we're just going to reshoot from scratch. We'll maintain, like, 20% of what was already shot, but we'll, you know, they took the same cast back to the same locations, tweaked the story a little bit to add lots more gore and lots more, like, horrific, like, jump scares, because they're like, oh, that one was too arty and slow burning, and, you know, when people are coming to see an Exorcist movie, they want to see a lot of cat scares and stuff. Like, it's just, they want to see bad CGI of wounded soldiers dying on the battlefield and their limbs falling off and stuff. Like, all this ludicrous stuff. And then it came out in theater and it bombed anyway. And so then a couple years later, they're like, oh, well, you still have that Paul Schrader cut. Let's stick that out on DVD and see if that becomes a little sleeper hit. And that's another one of those cases where you had a film being remade of a film without any time between their release. And it's very fascinating to compare the two of them. But it's a sort of thing, like one of them's more sort of restrained and stately, and it's only punctuated occasionally by kind of horrific things. And then you have the other one that's just kind of more, I don't want to say cheesy, but it's kind of like more fun, I guess. I think most people think the original Suspiria is probably more, feels more light because of the colorful nature and the music.
Oh yeah, no, I would agree. And I appreciate the lack of, there's not really any jump scares in either of these films, which I enjoy, because I'm going to go tell that guy, like, nobody wants jump scares. Like, maybe one. You get one per movie. It's like when movies are rated PG-13, and it's like you can say fuck one time. All horror movies are allowed one jump scare. Because I think now we're at the point in the conversation where we all kind of collectively agree that it's a cheap way to scare someone.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really, really like movies like both of the Suspiria films where that your terror is not coming from an abrupt noise, because what's creative about that? It's coming from the atmosphere and tension built in the movie, you know? Kind of like with survival horror titles, if your game just has jump scare after jump scare after jump scare, and right now I'm thinking of like AAA horror, like, I don't know, like The Evil Within, and the new Resident Evil reboot. If it's just that over and over and over again, that's not fun for your players. The same thing applies to scary movies. If that's all that your narrative is built on, and that's the only thing that makes it scary, it's probably not going to be a good movie.
You know what a good jump scare is? When it doesn't happen on screen, but it happens to the audience, regardless, because I was watching, what's the movie with James McAvoy? It's Split. You know, the middle chapter of Shyamalan's Unbreakable trilogy. It was near the end of that film, and an incredibly tense section of the film, building up. Everything was just like electric. You don't know what's going to happen. And then all of a sudden, my daughter bursts into the room, and the other person I was with, I thought, she was going to have a heart attack. She flew across, like, and I jumped too. I leapt from the couch, and I mean, it was like genuinely, like, I had not had that happen probably in my entire life of watching a film where I jumped because of something that had happened on screen. And granted, it's because we were very invested in what was happening in the film, and then suddenly there's this intrusion from behind. Like, I mean, that's such a, like, personal experience, but it says a lot that you can be, that your nerves can be ratcheted up to a certain degree that could happen. And I think that's way more effective than seeing a character have the same reaction on screen, and then you're supposed to somehow get telegraphed reaction from the same moment. Like, it doesn't work. At least not for me. I mean, I can't believe how often in the theater, even in some horror trailers, something will pop up and I see people jump and, like, oh my gosh, oh, that's so scary. And I'm just sitting there, like, completely just ice cold blood. I'm just like, what? Seriously? People react to that?
Hey, everyone has different sensitivity levels.
Yes.
And some of the things that have honestly scared me more than jump scares were, there was a scene in The Haunting of Hill House in the Netflix series that just came out where there's a long tracking shot in a funeral parlor, and there's stuff that happens in the background of the shot as the camera's moving around the scene, and there was a part where the ghost of the crooked neck lady, or bent neck lady, she's just chilling in the corner of the room, and I was immediately just like, ah! It's like, guys, turn around! They're like things that happen in the background that the characters aren't even aware of, but we as the audience.
Yeah, that's always really unnerving.
Like the ending scene of It Follows, where the two characters at the end are walking down the street and they think that they've killed it, but then the camera pans back and shows someone walking behind them. It's called there's a specific term, like film term, a denouement.
Denouement would just be the natural resolution following the climax. So, you know, if you're Return of the King, it's a 25-minute... I hate when people knock that, because I didn't think... I mean, yeah, it's a little bit repetitive, but I felt like every one of those little follow-ups were all important. But yeah, that's a denouement. Anything that follows the climax. The minute the ring goes into Mount Doom, everything after that point's denouement.
Okay, I feel like there's a specific word for this thing that I'm talking about. I can't remember what it is. It's going to drive me nuts. Anywho, the theme of this episode has been Morgan not knowing the names of anything and constantly forgetting words.
That's okay, because if we were having this conversation with a group of people at a horror convention, we would all be scrambling for our phones. Be like, wait a minute, who's that one guy? Wait, wasn't he in? Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, if we are going somewhere, like, in public, I will be a lot more prepared. But this is our first recording, and very low-key. So I was just like, I'll just go into it. And I was going to, like, research the film a little bit, but then just never did because of who I am as a person.
I don't think that always matters. I think, yeah, hopefully just us sharing our sort of perspectives one way or another, hopefully that's given people some interest one way or another about certain elements that can be discussed later, and hopefully some viewers agree or even vehemently disagree with some of it too. I love hearing just film talk, period. Contrast is great.
Yeah.
I could argue or just talk film nonstop. In fact, I will mention that 10 years ago there was a moment where I had two friends coming over for an evening, and they both showed up on time. It was 6 p.m., and one of them brought a case of beer, and the other one, I guess he just brought himself. And we both sat, as they walked in, and I'm greeting them in the kitchen. We get to talking, and we all three gravitated over towards the kitchen table and sat down to continue talking. Our intention was we were going upstairs to watch a couple of movies, and we got to talking about film, and that's all we talked about, very passionately, for what seemed like 2 hours, until one of us noticed finally, someone said, "Is that the sun?" And we looked, and it was suddenly light outside, and we all looked at each other, like, no way. We looked at the clock. It was almost 6 a.m. We had sat and talked for 12 hours, nonstop, without moving. None of us had eaten, gone to the restroom, popped open any of the beers. Like, we were so riveted by talking about film, time just flew. So, that's my qualification for doing a podcast with Morgan.
Do I have any? I'm the opposite. I have zero qualifications at all. If someone else tells you I have qualifications, they are lying.
Who needs qualifications when you have passion for what you're into?
So we're going to call it sure. Damon has the actual knowledge and credentials, but I'm lovable, and I think that that's enough.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes. Everyone would agree with that, I imagine, so.
Very kind.
Well, we'll hear, I guess. We'll hopefully be getting some feedback.
Yeah, we'll have to maybe organize the social media stuff a little bit.
Yeah.
I might have to actually start using Twitter and Instagram. But well, that'll be fine.
Yeah. So.
I have a Twitter, but I never use it. Anyway, that's not important.
Is there anything else that you want to add to your especially having such a clean slate coming to this? I mean, is there anything that you want to add to sum up your feelings about all of that, either film or both of them compared to each other?
I think that both films are good, but they are both good for different reasons, and depending on your preferences as an audience member, that's going to affect, like, which one you prefer. And maybe you don't like movies like either Suspiria at all, and that's okay, too. Everybody's got stuff in the genre that they like and that they don't like. How, you know, for example, I don't like movies where gore is the plot. And, you know, other than that, there isn't any plot. But I really enjoy movies about, like, witches and movies that kind of, in the same vein, oh, a really good example of this is I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. It's a Netflix exclusive, I think, so I don't know where everybody can stream it. If you guys are talented, you'll figure something out. But that movie is a really good example of almost being built entirely on just the atmosphere and the vibes that it gives off, which it does super great. And it's like also one of the most quiet, scary movies I've ever seen. There's not a lot of music. And there's not a whole lot of dialogue. But I really recommend it because one thing that I think that movie and these two movies do very well is build up, like, your sense of dread. Just based off of, like, cinematography and sound and visuals and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, everybody go watch I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, and also watch both of the Suspiria films. I do recommend watching the original before watching the remake. Not that you necessarily need to see one to get the other one, but I think you'll appreciate the remake more if you see the original first. Which tends to be true for, like, most situations.
Right. I'm trying to wrap my brain around what that would be like to experience the newer one and then go back. I wonder if it would be seen as just, I have no clue. I don't know how I would feel about that, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it would be like if this newer, you know, these newer class of youngins that are maybe seeing the new Star Wars movies before seeing the originals, but those are connected enough. Well, but the styles are really different. Okay. Backtrack. Don't know if that was the best example, because they're still very much like that it's all a linear canon. It's just that the styles and how they explore that canon vary a lot. Yeah. Like, they kept, like, the screen wipes and some of the effects, but when I watch the original and then when I go and I watch, like, The Force Awakens or The Last Jedi, I'm like, these movies do not have a lot of aesthetics in common anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of do because it's also Star Wars, but
yeah.
Disney really, like, I don't know, took some turtle wax to it, and now we have this completely, you know, thing that is vaguely shaped like the other thing, but is just... has a really different, like, surface-level appearance. I don't know. I'm rambling. It's fine. But do you understand what I'm trying to say, though?
Oh, yeah. Especially, you know, when you're dealing with films over such a period of time, it's inevitable that there's going to be sort of a mismatch and different sensibilities explored. And, you know, it's really hard to always compare things, like, objectively when they're from completely different eras.
Yeah, I would agree, because about the same amount of time passed between, God, that was okay.
Well, Suspiria came out the same year as Star Wars A New Hope, so, and then, Last Jedi came out the same year as the Suspiria remake, so.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. I was like, I felt like the Star Wars movies came out around the same time, and then we're getting, you know, the new trilogy around the same time that we're getting the Suspiria remake.
And I know there's someone out there saying, Last Jedi came out the year before. Yes, by a month difference of being straddling into the new year. But yes.
We never claim to be 100% right on anything ever. That seems like a real bad idea. You gotta take everything that we say with a grain of salt.
I've been told I have an encyclopedic knowledge of film, but that's like saying you have an encyclopedic knowledge of the goings-on of your neighborhood over the past century. Like, you can know a lot, but ultimately it's infinitesimal. No one could ever even begin to have a corner on film knowledge. That's just the way it is.
It's art. It's subjective. That person seeing your project, whether it's, you know, like a movie or it's a book or it's a game that you coded or whatever, everyone's going to relate to what they're seeing differently. And I get that that can be scary from an artist's point of view. Once you put your stuff out there, it's still yours and you made it, but you have zero control over how other people are going to feel about it or interpret it or whatever the case may be.
Indeed. Oh, I guess the only other thing I want to, two little things. These are very little bite-sized things. These are just observations I was wanting to make about the remake. Did you notice the casting of Jessica Harper, who played Susie Banyan in the first film, appearing in the remake?
What? No, where was she?
She's at the end on the street, and she, I've only seen the new one once, so I'm straining to remember exactly what she did, but I feel like she helped, she was escorting the elderly gentleman to his apartment. I may be mangling that horribly. I just remember she had a minor role, but she was on screen for a good 3 or 4 minutes, and it was kind of cool to see her back on screen looking exactly like she looked in 1977.
Well, I guess I'm just going to have to go back and rewatch this movie and look for her, which I will probably watch it again anyway. This is definitely, which also can be said for a lot of movies, that you always catch things when you rewatch them because you have the time to pay more attention to, like, every detail and every shot. But I'm positive that this is one of those movies where if you watch it again, you're going to catch things that are plot relevant or foreshadowing that you didn't see the first time.
Yeah, it's definitely got many layers to it, particularly with all the terrorist stuff going on the television screens that you see periodically. And one thing I'm hoping to gain a beat on, and I was hoping I wanted to ask you if you picked up anything about this. Did you see the little stinger scene at the end of the credits?
I did, but I had no idea. I just felt like it was a shot, and I had no context for it. So I'm like, what is
yeah,
she
doing? Yeah, see, I kind of had the same reaction. I felt like I didn't know exactly why it was supposed to be. I mean, I realized for that character, he got some sort of closure by, I don't know. There was like a closure to the story of that couple and how they had been separated, and seeing the evidence of the graffiti of that time, like, was supposed to bring some sort of closure. But to me, it felt a little, I don't want to say half-baked, it just felt like it didn't resonate like I thought it was supposed to. So I thought maybe I was missing something within that.
Well, I know what I would like it to be is I want it to be her touching the face of Tom's friend's character. I really like their relationship. It was kind of, it's probably not appropriate because she was a teacher and Susie's a student, but I was like, oh, well, they have chemistry. This isn't real, it's fine. If it was real, it would be weird.
Yeah, right.
Which is why I feel weird about it, and I'm saying things like it's fine to try to, like, get the weird feeling.
Well, see, I was already unhinged by that point in the film, that next to the last scene, or maybe that was the last scene before the credits, where you have Tilda Swinton's character as the elderly gentleman sitting up in bed, you know, reflecting back on, you know, this lost love. And I thought, because I knew that Tilda Swinton was playing the character in the movie before going into the film, I felt like it seemed like they were trying to be so hush-hush about it. I thought it was because there was a big reveal. And I thought that in that moment, suddenly there was going to be like this sudden, like her identity was going to become known and she was going to like energetically like come forward and, you know, you see this frail old man and now here she is and she's like, asserting her dominance, like, you know, I suckered you into believing me and, you know, here I am. And, you know, like there was going to be some sort of a showdown on the basis of her having pretended to be this man that Susie Banyan's character could confide in. And then nothing. Like, you're just supposed to be like, oh, you're just 100% to the end, you're supposed to believe that that's a male character, which I thought was brilliant. But it seemed like because they were so secret about it, it led me to believe that it was going to be a big cliffhanger within the movie.
That would have been really interesting. I'm trying to envision, like, how that would have gone down, and it's really hard because I kind of liked the neat resolution to his story and that there wasn't necessarily going to be another huge, oh, this person was this other person the whole time. I'm like, we just did this, like, not that long ago in the basement with a bunch of naked ladies. It was real weird, but I'm just saying, we did that already.
Yeah, once you've got that scene, which it seems like it goes on for a long time. I mean, it feels like a full 14 minutes of nonstop orgy, full on, like, you know, demons walking around and 50 completely nude women bathed in blood. You know, it's very over the top and frenetic, very nightmarish in a lot of ways. It brings to mind some of Goya's paintings. So, yeah, I could see how it would have been perhaps weird to try to have some, like, last-minute kind of shocker of a ending with that sort of reveal. But, just to find out that I did not know it until months later was that Tilda Swinton played the mother of, which mother was it? And that was something else I was going to bring up was, this is actually, Suspiria was the first of a trilogy that actually did get completed. The second film being Inferno, third film being The Mother of Tears. So, you know, it's not just, this remake was not only a remake of the first film, but it's, you know, it's interesting to ponder. Would Luca Guadagnino ever consider making this its own standalone trilogy by remaking Inferno and Mother of Tears as well? But yeah, Tilda Swinton playing the, I don't remember which mother she was, but the fact, the very corpulent and disgustingly vile naked witch in that scene. But that's her that whole time is fascinating.
Wait, that's who else she played? Yeah. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, yeah. And then it throws you because Tilda Swinton as the headmaster is it within the same scene. Interacting with her.
I know. That is really cool. I did not know that. I want to know how they did that. I will Google that later.
Well, this is all coming up because you were talking about how probably watching the film repeatedly would reveal all kinds of new stuff. And, yeah, there's all sorts of things like that. You know, I start thinking of, oh, yeah, Suspiria really was one of three films. And there's all this other history of these characters. And that, you know, Guadagnino kind of touched on some of the stuff from the later sequels, all within that orgy scene. So I don't know. It's just one of those things that's endlessly fascinating to try to ponder.
I would love to see remakes of the other movies, which I haven't seen, but if they keep the same guy and he keeps his aesthetics really similar across the other two, then I would love to see those.
I mean, I would love that too. I highly doubt it because, you know, he is first and foremost an art house director, and for him, this was just it was an outlet for him really having an obsession with this movie since the age of 12. But, and particularly with the box office, I mean, the film just wasn't, you know, like critically it wasn't astounding enough, or commercially it wasn't. If it had been a huge commercial success, I could have seen how they would have probably convinced him into doing a follow-up, or maybe, you know, treat it the same as just doing a retread of the whole original Argento trilogy. But Helena Marcos, duh. I can't believe, yeah, I know the character of Helena Marcos so well from the original film. You really get a sense of her name and her history in that original movie. But yeah, that's Helena Marcos, the really corpulent, vile one there at the end of the remake. And that is also Tilda Swinton.
Nice. Did not know that.
But in the credits, she's credited as Lutz Ebersdorf. So, like, you would never know just by looking at the credits that was her. But it is.
No. You are correct. So they did a... Yeah, I like that. That's fun.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, we could go on forever about these, but unless there's anything else you want to add to it, we can wrap up this episode and get started on the next.
Yay! Damon, you'll have to edit it to make me sound smart. I know what I'm talking about. Please, if you could just do me this small gargantuan favor, I would really appreciate it.
It's just us being us. We're just being us.
I know, and this was my first time recording, so again, a little nervous. I promise I'm more fun when I'm not. So self-conscious. Anywho. Ending thoughts are mostly, I recommend both of these films, but keep your mind open and your expectations open. And Tilda Swinton is great.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really interesting to see a body be literally contorted to death in a weird mirror room. And also, there's the devil, only not really. And that's why you should watch this movie. Welcome to my... Thank you for coming to my TED Talk about why Suspiria is great.
Yes. TED Talk for horror. How cool would that be?
We should do that. We could totally do that. We are not qualified at all, but we could do it.
This is no longer called the Scream Team. This is now called...
Welcome to my TED Talk.
TED Talk horror. I don't know.
Pretty sure we would have to pay royalties. I appreciate your enthusiasm.
What if we did, like, you know, we don't have to say anything about Ted, but, like, we could go out on a stage to where we've got, like, the red lighting against the curtain, and then, like, we'd have, like, letters standing in the background that stood for, like, Scream Team, but they would be in the same font and everything as Ted, and so people kind of get that vibe. And we could, like, cut to, like, fake audience reactions of people cheering and stuff.
Yes! I think that would that would be a lot of fun. I am 100% in support of this.
We'd be getting all sorts of invites all over the place to all these big horror conventions to come talk.
Please.
Okay, I think we're done.
Okay. Once again, this has been Morgan, and that's Damon.
And Damon.
Together we are Scream Team. Thank you, ladies and germs. Have a good rest of your night.
Sweet dreams.